Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. Part two this week from Glastonbury Abbey of a two-part series. An hour down the A37 is where history was made in 1539. That's the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII and the execution of the brave abbot Richard Whiting, who was having nothing to do with Henry's dissolution. He was hung, drawn and quartered on the Tor for his trouble. But the abbey went right back to the 7th century, 712. That's 800 years. It was one of the most powerful institutions in southwest England. We hear this week from Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder. Part one was last week. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
Actually talks about some of the documents produced here were fake, and we're back to fake news again. They were manufactured to make the abbey more important. So some of the land grabs that we've been talking about were actually not real, in the sense that we didn't really own them. We then got them because there were false documents provided. So
it's a bit naughty.
Very naughty. But, I mean, that is well documented that some of these are totally false.
Another reason why maybe the Abbey wasn't quite so supported by the people living around here, you know, if these kind of rumours of this kind of thing got out. OK, so what about this building here? Could you just take us through what would have been going on here? I mean, this is the sort of high-end kitchen.
Yeah, so we're standing in the high-end kitchen, the abbot's kitchen. We're in the main kitchen area here. There would have been ancillary kitchen rooms going off through either door. So we wouldn't be going outside when we exited this building. We're going to more rooms. But you've got the rough layout as to how it would have functioned. First of all, there's four fires, one in each corner. And each fire in this sort of medieval kitchen would have had its own distinct purpose and use. We're standing on the western side of the kitchen at the moment, and the western side of the kitchen would have been what they called the wet side of the kitchen, and that's where we'd be cooking, or they would be cooking with water and liquids. So standing right next to us, we've got a cauldron fire. So this is your medieval hob on your kitchen cookertop. So everything we can cook in a saucepan today, so stews, soups, pie fillings, sauces, ragouts, boiling meat and vegetables, that sort of idea, on the wet side of the kitchen again. The fire opposite it, the other fire, there's actually a big drain, and that would have been the scullery fire, the fire for washing up, cleaning. And, of course, you could use the scullery fire as a cooking fire as well at times of great capacity and need. So we're in the wet side of the kitchen. That means that the other side of the kitchen, the eastern side of the kitchen, is the dry side of the kitchen. So we have a spit, of course, very important in a high-status medieval environment, the meat, the high-status food. You're producing all of your lovely meat over there, your medieval barbecue. And across from the spit, it's hard to see from here, we've got an oven in the wall. And that little oven there is later oven. But you might see, if you squint in the white wall above, a large row of bricks. Show how large the oven used to be. It's a great industrial size oven. And what we believe that would be for is largely for pastries, desserts, cakes. Again, fine food. You wouldn't bake most of your breads in that oven because you would have bakeries on site churning out loaves of bread a day, you know, quite a large number of loaves a day. So this really is your kind of high status kitchen then. So you've got your four main cooking areas, probably some room in the middle for preparation. And then to tie in this idea of importance, we would have potentially, this is kind of a modern interpretation and suggestion that we know they did have in medieval kitchens, it's more than possible they had here, we potentially would have had a head chef's gallery. And that's what this ironwork structure here represents in the kitchen going across. You might see a pillar base on one side of the kitchen and a pillar base on the other that isn't mirrored on the side of the kitchen we're on. You can imagine a beautiful carved gantry above there where you'd have the head chef or a steward or deputy standing to oversee all the work in the kitchen. You can imagine Gordon Ramsay standing up there shouting and screaming and swearing at his cook down below him. But again, this is about that fine food, and he's really controlling the kitchen. Because some of the food coming through here would be very expensive spices, sturgeon, expensive fish, massively expensive produce. So that's got to be itemised and checked. And we have CCTV in modern restaurants watching the cooks. It's exactly the same thing here, having someone on the gantry.
So he'd be the sort of maître d'hôtel or something.
Oh, yeah. This is a medieval Michelin star restaurant kitchen, basically, that kind of idea.
I entertained Michelin star cooks from New York in here, what, three years ago, and I did a cooking demonstration for them. And the nouveau cuisine that we're so used to isn't nouveau at all, because actually the ingredients haven't changed. You know, eggs, cream, meat, vegetables. All that's changed in modern cooking is the technology of how we put it together and the spices and the things that we put in with it.
Well, if you can imagine some amazing banquets being produced in here. Yeah, you mentioned briefly the scale of Glastonbury compared to other abbeys around the country, and this was certainly the longest church in the country, but how does it compare to, where are the other sort of top-notch abbeys around Britain?
Yeah, other than Westminster, yeah, I'd say Westminster, in terms of size, we're certainly longer than Westminster.
And land ownership and sort of wealth, I mean, you're talking about into the billions in today's money.
What you're talking, it's very difficult to say. I mean, what we do know is that Westminster Abbey is a good example to use because that did very much vie for kind of the title of wealthiest abbey in England, basically. If you look at kind of the records that we do have, we can see that Westminster Abbey and Glastonbury Abbey have a very similar value. We don't know what that value amounts to, as in what comprises of the value necessarily. We know that the end yearly kind of produce value in pounds of that, medieval pounds, not modern pounds, is about getting on for £3,500 to £4,000 a year, depending on, this is at the end of the abbey's lives in the late 15th century and early 16th century. I don't really know what you could translate that to in modern pounds, but
Far exceeded Westminster in today's terms of 1.3 billion at least. Value, and that's what Henry VIII put the value on. I mean, that's what his commissioners did. So, as we look up, as we spoke in the churches about your eyes are raised up, we raise our eyes here, and you see the beautiful, slender stonework supporting this magnificent arch. And if you went into a similar building in Egypt or in the Middle East, this is exactly the same design, and it's got huge Islamic influence. And what you're seeing at the top there is actually medieval air conditioning, which this what you're looking at there is over 700 years old.
We've got a massive vaulted ceiling here with, I said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Is that air gaps? Basically, a giant chimney in the roof.
9, 10, yes. Well, that's where the hot air goes out, and then the cold air is sucked in through the middle, because as the air goes up, it moves faster and faster because of the dome. It then is going out through the slits at a higher speed. That sets up a vortex that actually brings in the cold air.
So you've actually got cold air coming in from the ceiling as well.
Yes, and it's all worked with shutters. So they aren't there now, but there would have been wooden shutters so as to alter the airflow.
Brilliant bit of design. Well
absolutely
done.
Absolutely fantastic.
And, and probably overlooked by most people that come through here.
And how many kitchens have stained medieval stained glass? I mean, you look at the decoration in here, and it's just sort of quite interesting.
So how come this building is still here? Because most of the buildings around the monastery here have gone, haven't they?
I think partly due to its construction and also the materials used in it. I mean, you're looking at a very large building. If you look at the walls, they're at least 3 feet thick, if not thicker. This building is built to be entirely fireproof. I would challenge anyone, not literally, to burn this building down. It is designed to be fireproof. There's no wood in the roof. There's no lead on the roof to be stolen. And that roof in itself, again, above us, is pretty much keystone construction, like a bridge. You remove one or two bricks from the side of this wall, you compromise its design, it's going to collapse on your head. You would need to put up scaffolding and slowly take it down from the top downwards. That's a huge expense. The whole point of recycling the stone is a quick grabbing of building materials, not an investment in deconstruction. We also have the fact that we know that this building went through a number of uses after the dissolution. It was a very sound, strong building. It's going to be here for a good while longer. And it had further uses.
So what uses was it after the dissolution? I find that fascinating.
Within about 10 years, the Duke of Somerset owned this building, and he brought over Flemish weavers. And you can see the holes in the wall where they put a floor in there over that side of the kitchen. And the weavers were brought over because we produced, as we've said earlier on, fantastic wool, but we were hopeless at weaving it. The best weavers in the world were Flemish, Dutch and Italian. And if you think about it, Italian cloth, Italian suits is still highly sought after. So weavers were brought in. They did the weaving up there in the light and lived down here where we're standing. And then it became a farm building. It was used by people. It was then in more recent times used as a place for worship, wasn't it?
Very brief period of the Quakers using this as a meeting house.
These chairs are from there, aren't they?
I believe, maybe not from the original use of this as a crowd. I'm not too sure. Maybe from street, these ones, I'm not too sure. But okay. Yes, there is a link there to these benches. Yeah.
What's left of it?
Well, I mean, you're talking of the hierarchy. If you just stand here, just over here,
we'll get a feel for it.
You can see here where the archaeologists have marked out. You can see this is the dining hall, the refectory. Goes all the way back here, along the wall there. This is the dining hall just for one monk, the boss monk, all right, who was the abbot, who's also a bishop. And all these buildings are part of his palace. So when you survey all this for one person and his important guests, it's huge.
Hang on, how can he be an abbot and a bishop at the same time? Isn't that cheating?
Yes, it is, but then it just shows you how important he is. So he was so important. But if you look straight ahead to the left of that fir tree, you'll see that is the refectory for, 50, 60, 70 monks at its height, depending if they were all here. So one monk, 50, 60 monks.
So, okay, so we're talking about a total number of monks here under 100?
Yes.
Yeah, we have very few monasteries in England ever exceed 100 in number of monastic individuals. And that's not to say that is the population of the monastery or the working population of the monastery. You might find 50, 60 monks here, but then a support staff in at least over 100 support staff or more. Remember, running a vast local estate, not just the massive estate around here, but also the local environment, and running a day-to-day monastery of this size and this calibre would need a large number of support staff as well.
Well, let's just talk a bit about what the monastery was able to give back to the locals, because one thing I do know is that there was a certain amount of healthcare that they did offer through infirmaries. In fact, I'm in Bristol, we've got the Bristol Royal Infirmary still. Yeah. It's called an infirmary. So I guess that's a hangover from the days of the monasteries.
Well, I mean, that's where it all started. Over the whole of Europe, where did you go for your education? You went to the monastery.
Well, I thought you didn't have one.
What?
An education, no.
If you didn't pay for it.
Well, and some people, were, because of their status, were taken in. If you wanted health, if you wanted medicines, where did you go? Cadfael. All right, we've all... you went to the monastery. If you were starving, Where did you come? You came here for the dole, and or as we've been looking at, for the almshouses and all those sorts of things. So the church was set up as a social institution to reach out to society to deal with those in need, and it lost its way. And that's why, of course, people were very happy to see...
There are accounts, for example, in London, slightly after the dissolution, of there being a bit of a problem with the homeless and destitute. And we have private guilds of lawyers and other individuals setting up funds to build hospices because the monasteries have been destroyed. And it would be like, not in the same context at all, but if you think of it on a kind of similar parallel to immediately removing the NHS overnight and your social services and then having the problems that fall out from that, you've got the same kind of environment on a much different scale, of course. But that similar feeling and ethos, you've got kind of this, the social services that were there at the time, not that there were many, come from the monasteries. You're eradicating that, and then you suddenly have this lack in society of this social care almost. It's gone. And so we do see this reaction in London of guilds setting up their own private institutions to help cope with this problem, and charitable institutions. So they did certainly have this effect that was felt after the dissolution when they were gone. So there certainly is that charitable aspect towards the care.
It's huge social change. I mean, we look at the Middle East and we look at ISIS and think of the criminality of destroying. But here, under Cromwell, under dissolution, huge social change, devastation of so many of our monuments and things all went.
And can you just tell us a little bit about the Puritans? Because I understand that they actually were going around churches taking down statues, and I mean, that actually is, you were talking about ISIS, this is the kind of thing that they were doing. They were destroying some of the religious artifacts and things like that. Was there any kind of logic to their thinking? What was that all about?
I think it's very much, again, you can talk about the idea of, it's all about symbolism, isn't it? You're destroying the old to make way for the new, or you're destroying what you believe is taboo or wrong or somehow unjust. And rather than kind of leaving it there for, as it were, cultural memory under whatever system, this doesn't become important anymore. So the idea is you're eradicating it, and you're making that statement. You're saying, this is bad, this is old, we shouldn't go there. This is wrong. And whatever angle you go from, it's about this sending that message of, again, we can go back to the idea of going back to prehistoric sites being abandoned or ritual deposition. Often items of ritual deposition are broken before they're put in. To get past something, you break it. And I think that's the same thing they're doing here.
Well, they certainly did that with the Abbey, didn't they? Yeah. You mentioned the Duke of Somerset. Was it as simple as that? That the estate was just sold off, or what?
Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, the commissioners, and it was the Court of Augmentations that was responsible. After the commissioners were here, the commissioners would have sold off some of the stuff immediately, given pensions to the monks who needed and the staff, and some were very generous pensions.
Hush money?
Well, that's why they went. I mean, most of the monasteries went voluntarily. The abbot here, as you know, was hung, drawn and quartered right in front of us on the tour there. A very bloody end. But he resisted. Most of the others had pensions of between £80 and £100 at that time, which would be, in today's money, would be considerable wealth.
Considering you're looking at a lot of kind of average, for example, nuns at Shaftesbury Abbey would be given a pension of between £4 and £6 a year, depending on their seniority. Yeah. And actually, £6 a year is a reasonable living. It'd be kind of, you know, you'd be able to live off it, as it were. So it wasn't in their interest to resist and necessarily be executed for...
As Abbot Whiting was. Let's just go back to that. This is quite a nasty incident, and I guess it was towards the end of the dissolution of the monasteries, and it was really as a result of him trying to assert his authority over the king, in a way, yeah?
Yes, very much so.
That's Henry VIII. Henry VIII wouldn't have liked that.
No. And partly because of his piety. I mean, he was a spiritual man and believed that this was a place worthy to preserve and didn't want it to go the same way. So
he was prepared to put his life on the line.
Absolutely. Some people took the money and ran, and he was prepared to put his life on the line, along with two of his monks who were the treasurers, who were accused, of course, of stealing. And that's why they were hung and Richard Whiting drawn and quartered up there, because they hid the finances they stole from the church. That was the probably trumped up reason.
Ultimately, you've got to remember that at the time the church has just been taken control of by the king, so if you're stealing from the church, you're effectively stealing from the monarch, which is treason. So that kind of idea. So it's
but you see, hang on, because surely one of the things Henry VIII was doing was cancelling various debts and things like that, so in a way he was stealing from the church.
Oh, yes, yes, very much.
So it's all about money, this.
That's the whole thing. Everything about the dissolution in the monastery, it's not about Henry having a new wife, it's not about kind of various social things, it's all about land, money and power, as it always has been.
Here we're standing underneath what was the original chapel to Mary above, which was the first building on the site of after the fire of 1184. Where we're standing was dug out much later. This is the chapel to St. Joseph, who became a very important cult figure later on in late medieval times. And you can see here where the altar behind us, and you can see in the stonework that's supporting the arches above here, little holes.
Well, we're right in the very, very basement of what would have been the abbey, the crypt, I suppose you'd call it.
This would have been a good way of explaining it, a crypt, an undercroft. We've just been through the well, but these holes were, you'd had wires in there, or bits of string or whatever, holding various votive offerings, perhaps limbs or things that had been healed or whatever. So this would have all been here.
Hang on, limbs?
Models.
You come here for healing. You have a crippled arm, maybe, you have a broken leg. You come to the abbey for healing. The idea is that you leave a votive offering of a representation of that ailment behind.
So let me guess that you've got to buy that from the abbey.
Okay. Well. They certainly might sell you one if you asked, something like that. But you can imagine then this idea of... it's not too dissimilar to this idea of necessarily tree dressing. We see people making a wish or a prayer, tying
Christmas trees. You know,
yeah,
we decorate those.
Tying something in onto the tree. It's kind of make that binding, that wish binding. The same thing's happening here. You're making your wish, your hope, and then you're leaving behind this kind of method of binding. You're leaving behind the symbology of that prayer you left, you know, kind of. It's the same kind of thing, just in a different parallel. But
okay, well, let's get back to Richard Whiting.
So we've got the dissolution.
1536. Started really sort of 1535. Even before there were sort of mutterings. Whiting became abbot after Beer's death.
I mean, just also in context, I'm just thinking this is around about, 15 years after Martin Luther and the Reformation started? So it was
In Germany, but the Reformation didn't come here until... It didn't really kick in until after Henry VIII died under his son Edward. That's when it really kicked in.
So this was the beginning of the Reformation, really?
It was
dissolution.
The beginning. Henry VIII resisted a lot of the Reformation ideas... To begin with, he gradually softened on various things over the end, but he was still a Roman Catholic himself right to the end. Although he was supposedly head of the Church of England, you can see it's all very beautifully mixed up.
Okay, so how does what happened to Richard Whiting fit in the broader context of the Reformation then? And the dissolution?
Again, as with everything, it's about kind of this whole idea of power and politics. You've got an abbot of an exceptionally wealthy and powerful monastery, the premier, if not one of the premier monasteries in England, very powerfully connected at court and in powerful circles, and you've got him done away with, executed in this exceptionally violent and barbaric manner. I think the idea is that it's this political message saying that if we can topple Glastonbury, no other monastic house can even stand a chance of resisting. And then we do find a lot of monasteries surrender, of course, when they come and ask them, because it's setting precedence to this kind of the treatment of what will happen if you deny us, as it were, deny the king's commissioners. You know, there will be this reckoning to be had in this.
But hanging, drawing, and quartering sounds nasty. What does it actually involve?
Basically, what you would do is they would hang the individual until for a while, as it were, hanging by a noose. But cut them down before they expire, traditionally. They would then be drawn, which usually means being tied down by your arms and legs, and then being disemboweled. Not always, but usually they try and keep the individual alive while they do this. Then they often burn the entrails in front of them. And then finally, to finish it, they'll strike the head off the body, and then the body will be quartered into four pieces, and each piece will usually be sent to a different area to display at different points of the country or different areas.
Yeah, this is pretty barbaric stuff, isn't it? Whoever's doing this is not trying to take the moral high ground.
Yeah, this is the ultimate punishment. This is the punishment for treason. This is the ultimate punishment you can face in England at the time, as it were, other than, of course, a spiritual punishment such as being excommunicated. So this really is the most barbaric punishment you can ascribe to someone. And that's why I believe it's all about this very powerful message saying, you know, the most powerful monastery we can close and topple with this act, you know. And it's that sort of
And there was further mutilations too. I mean, men would often have their private parts cut off beforehand. Women would have their breasts cut off and various other things. I mean, it was brutality at its worst. I mean,
the idea, of course, is to send a shock wave of fear. Absolutely. A shock, and I imagine it did that, send that shock wave of fear right around the country.
Well, that's why so many of the monks and the heads of the convents took the money and went. Because Henry VIII was a very, very clever political operator, along with Cromwell. They started on the small ones, the easy ones, the ones that weren't financially sound, they began to topple, and then the whole thing began to collapse like Topsy. I mean, it was a very, very clever political manoeuver, really. I mean, it was very, very clever.
And then, of course, giving an opportunity to some of Henry's friends and colleagues to take over the estates, and also absolutely quite smart. Anyway, I know that there was some sort of memorial service for the first time this year, am I right about?
Yes. 15th of November, although it was under the old calendar, so it wouldn't have been quite the same date under the modern calendar, but that doesn't matter. So yes, 15th of November, 1539, when Richard Whiting was dragged up to the Tor. He was strapped, he was brought from Wells, where the trial was in the Bishop's Palace, on the 14th of November, where he was found guilty by Lord John Russell and his group there. He was then probably kept there overnight, brought here in the morning, strapped to a wooden hurdle, stripped naked, and towed up to the top of Glastonbury Tor. How many people were jeering and how many people had tears, we don't know. Some people would have been absolutely devastated and shedding tears.
Thankfully, we don't see this sort of thing too much in the world today, these kind of public executions.
Well, thankfully, except, of course, when you think, well, not around too much in the world. Well, we've just seen a lot in the Middle East, beheadings in Congo over the last few months. It just shows what human beings are like when we allow the base elements to come into play.
Thank you.
Tell us about the memorial. What inspired that? What's the point of that?
It was a local community, really, and it's important that we remember. As we said earlier, it's important to have things that mark things, like Stonehenge, like stones or whatever they are. And it was just important. And we had, 15, 16 people, all from the local community, all come and just spend some time reflecting and then thinking of what footprint. I mean, Richard Whiting left an important footprint in history. We're remembering it. What sort of footprint are you and I going to leave? Who's going to remember you in 10 years' time or 50 years' time or even 1,000 years' time or me? And it makes you think. And so, yes, we had only 20 minutes, but a time of thinking of who he was, what he did, and what the implication may be for us today in how we're carrying that sort of forward, because we're still part of the history of Glastonbury. You standing here today, holding this microphone, you are still a part, you're playing your part in the ongoing history of thousands of years of what's been going on here.
Some people see Glastonbury as a sort of magnet for nutcases. People with all sorts of crazy beliefs seem to gravitate here. What is that justified, do you think, to say that?
No. It's a bit unfair saying everyone coming here is crazy. I think the thing is that Glastonbury always has been a place where people have come to seeking something. And this has been seen in the Middle Ages with the monastery being here and people coming on pilgrimage for various problems they have in their life or ailments they have. We see this going into the Anglo-Saxon period as well, and possibly earlier than that as well with the various religious sites around the area. And now today that continuity has continued. People are coming to Glastonbury. Often there's a lot of mythology built and modern religion built out of the myths and legends. And I think people come here and can find acceptance. They can find a way if they're lost in life. There's so much happening in the town from all sorts of different spiritual angles and aspects that it's hard not to find acceptance in a place to be in Glastonbury. So you can come from any walk of life and any creed, come here, and there will be people who accept you for that.
Very much so, really. And I mean, you think we're talking about the dissolution, we're talking about Richard Whiting being hung, drawn and quartered, we're talking about the intolerance. And yes, some people would think we're weird and strange and all those sorts of things, but actually it's about tolerance. It's about listening to one another. It's about respecting one another. And so the intolerance that we've seen in the history in the past, perhaps, I don't know, but perhaps, just perhaps, it may have made us a little bit more tolerant and willing to listen and to engage with people.
Well, the other thing is the Abbey is a symbol of today. The ruined Abbey is falling away of faith. I mean, back in medieval times, most people were believers in God of one sort or another. Nowadays, we keep hearing the opposite, don't we?
Well, you have a different faith. I mean, people have the faith that Amazon's going to deliver in 24 hours and that, you know, that you pick up your phone and it'll work. I mean, we have a different sort of faith, in a sense. It's faith all the same. I mean, we don't know that Amazon's going to deliver, as they say. we don't know that. And as you travelled here this morning in your lovely car or whatever it was, you know, you had the faith that we'd get here, and then you found something that sort of got in the way a bit. So it's just interesting that, yes, there is a falling away of religiousness, but actually there's a rise in spirituality. People asking questions about who are we, why are we here?
Well, no, hang on. I think you're wriggling off the hook there, because, I mean, if you ask people whether they believe in God in medieval times, I would imagine most people would say they did. I mean, even if we're going back towards the end of the medieval times, even 100, 200 years ago, now the belief in God is much less.
Nowadays, people don't often accept things at face value as much as we have done in the past. It goes into the idea of modern kind of social enlightenment and social mobility, and social connection, things like that. So you're not necessarily always taking what you're told by rote, as it were. You're actually going out and investigating things for yourself. You're allowed to question a lot more. Even 100 years ago, questioning certain things was very much a social taboo. You didn't do it. You just did what you were told and that sort of thing. And the idea that today we're becoming a lot more of a free society in many senses, a lot more freedom of thought. And so I think it allows for a lot more opening up of people to question these things. And as Mark says, that does allow for this idea of people falling away from religion. It doesn't mean they're falling away from a sense of spirituality, but they're certainly falling away from this conventional religion. They're allowed to question it, maybe nowadays is a better term of saying, whereas in the past, you haven't been allowed to question it. Even into almost the relatively recently, you haven't been able to question it. Otherwise, you are socially ostracised from your community, or it's that crazy person down the street. The idea now, we're given remit and a bit of scope and breathing space to be able to sit back and say, well, hang on a minute, is that right? Does that need to happen? Do I need to believe in this entity to be a good person? Do I need to follow this doctrine to be a good person? And the answer largely, in many cases, is no, you don't. You can be a good person anyway. I think a lot of people are discovering that and finding their own way in it. And Glastonbury fits perfectly into that, with this whole range of belief and emotion, the idea that you can come here with any belief and find something and that sort of thing.
Tony, you may perhaps be just perpetuating a Western perception that God is no longer believed in by people, because if you go to other parts of the world, then the number of people believing that there's a God, whether it's Islamic or something else, is still huge and gaining. So it may be just a slight sort of blip from a Western point of view, from our culture and our perception. But I think if you were living in South America or some in Africa and places, that you may get a different answer to your question.
What about anyone interested in visiting the Abbey? The bottom line is, I mean, it's reasonably easy to get here by bus, although there's no railway station in Glastonbury, is there?
Under Beeching, we could do with the railways.
The bottom line is, how much is it to visit if you've got a family, for example?
So current prices to visit the Abbey and come in for the day. Your ticket lasts all day. You can come in and out of the Abbey, explore the rest of Glastonbury, come in and out of the Abbey as much as you like. For an adult, it's £8.25. For a concession or student, it's £7.15. For a child, it will be £4.95. Under fives are free with their parent. And a family ticket is £21.45. We have our kind of season pass, as it were, our year pass. And that costs around £40. But then once you've come a few times...
By people who are living in Glastonbury,
yeah, like some people who live further afield get that from Bristol, say. Because if you only come in a couple of times during the year, it's usually paid for itself anyway. So we do find people from further afield take that one as well.
What about people who say, well, you shouldn't be charging for people to come into these ruins? In fact, some people might want to come here just to be quiet and still... bit of time of prayer or something?
Yeah, well, we do have days where we have services like Eucharists in the small St Patrick's Chapel, run by Mark, who we just talked to occasionally, and they're free for entry if people want to come in and be part of that and join that. Any other forms of religious visit or religious experience, we ask that you get written permission first before coming here, but we usually are very amenable and flexible to
people. Okay, well, look, you've got a museum. Let's go and have a little look at that.
Okay.
This is obviously very bang up to date. You've got these kind of what look like touch screens here.
This was part of a joint project we did with the University of Reading, originally to look at all of the archaeology that had been done at the Abbey for the last century and republish it and rewrite it, because a lot of the work hadn't properly been interpreted and looked at in a modern sense. And out of that research came a lot of new knowledge, and some of that knowledge we wanted to display to the public in a modern, up-to-date fashion, and so we produced these digital panels, and it very much was with the work of the University of Reading. And so we've got all sorts of digital reconstructions, information about various periods of the Abbey's history on here to see. It largely focuses here on the earlier period of the Abbey's history, so the Anglo-Saxon monastery, and that's largely because until we did this research we didn't know a lot about the earlier history of the Abbey. So now we know more about it, we've been able to display it in this manner.
Now look, one of the things I can see immediately there is Arthur's tomb. It sounds to me a little bit like the Joseph of Arimathea myth. Is there actually any evidence for Arthur? And I always thought that was just sort of made up What do we actually know?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, what we do know is that the monks certainly claimed in the year 1191 to have discovered the burial of King Arthur in their old graveyard.
Was King Arthur then? Because wasn't he just made up?
Well, very difficult. We don't know if there was ever a true King Arthur. A lot of the stories we have of King Arthur today are more modern reimaginings. So Malory's King Arthur from the later medieval period. It's very much this high medieval knightly king who attends tournaments and jousts. We have a Victorian reimagining of King Arthur in the very same vein and light. What we seem to view today is that if there was a King Arthur, he would have existed in the time of the Saxon occupation of England, resisting this time. So we're talking the 500s, maybe dipping into the very late 5th century, something like that. So we're looking at someone who might be more of a tribal war leader or chieftain than anyone who actually represents a king.
He sounds a bit more like Alfred. Did he just not get the name?
Alfred the Great, or possibly, yeah, I'm separated by a few hundred years. Yeah, but it's that sort of idea. And so we've got this idea of this person who could have existed back in that time, potentially. But what we do know, the earliest records we have of Arthur aren't written until the early medieval period, so we had this big gap of about 400 years anyway of narrative. And of course, the medieval writers depict stories from the past in the present day. It'd be like us doing a reimagining of the Nativity set now, and that's the way every medieval kind of storyteller sets their stories. This idea is that they start writing about King Arthur, especially in the 11th and 12th centuries, and this is the height of chivalry, the height of romance in court. And so what do they represent King Arthur as? A chivalric hero with all the love and passion of court attached to him.
But they also had King Arthur's tomb, apparently, according to this. Now, this is very highly decorated, it looks incredibly impressive, but perhaps... So, a forgery.
Perhaps we genuinely had a tomb of King Arthur here at Glastonbury that was contained up inside the choir of the church. There were a number of eyewitness accounts from the medieval period of people visiting this. We had King Edward III come here to visit the tomb, and that's what this picture you see in front of you, this gaudy, beautiful tomb with the decoration of the church, is based off. It's based off a reference to the visit of Edward III. And the reference to it describes the tomb in great detail as to how it would have looked, and even talks about the skulls of Arthur and Guinevere placed on beautiful silk cushions in front of the tomb for the king to see, and you can see that down here. They also talk about the tomb being supported by four beautifully carved white marble lions, and that it's a black canopy, richly adorned. And this is very common for many high-status tombs within monastic enclosures. Whether or not this is genuine, or whether it's part, again, of this building of legacy and building of prestige and importance that the monks were very much involved in here.
And it was be a drawer, I suppose. People would want to come and see this, and maybe that's why it was cooked up. I keep hinting at this, but I do think that these kind of myths actually sold the abbey around the world.
Well, it did. Whether they are true or not, it sold the abbey around the world. That's an undeniable fact. This is part of the medieval brand of Glastonbury, as it were. Having Joseph and King Arthur as, you know, related to these sites, it very much is about spreading the word of Glastonbury. As to whether these myths are true or not, again, we always leave that up to personal belief, because we don't have enough evidence to say they're true. We don't have enough evidence to say they're false. What we can do is we can have a quick look at the top of the museum, maybe, and show you what I believe to be one of the best pieces we have in the museum that highlight the overall magnificence of the monastery. And that would be this piece up here. This is the Othery Cope, which is a ritual vestment or article worn by maybe the abbot or the prior, a high-status monk, during an important service.
Now, it looks like, is it black? It looks very, very dark, and it's got a whole collection of what look like fleur-de-lises and angels and all over it, in kind of silver and white.
Yeah, it's a green velvet cloth, incredibly expensive. And what it's got on it is a lot of applied embroidery showing Mary in the centre. It's got angels on it. It's got, again, the fleur-de-lises and the floral patterns. And if you look closely at Mary and the angels, you will see embedded in their wings real golden wire. This is gold wire. And we're talking about an article of clothing that would have cost the equivalent or more of a labourer's yearly wage here. But this shows the idea of that high status ritual, that high status display of wealth, display of pageantry. And again, the display of that otherworldliness of this environment and this church. You come in here on that service, we've already talked about that before. You see all the colour around you, and you see these priests, these monks officiating in your service, dressed in the most magnificent colours and clothing, and it adds to that overall feeling of awe and something that you wouldn't really experience in many places.
What date are we talking about?
We're not entirely sure of a date of it, but definitely within the life of the abbey. It was actually found under an altar at a local church in Othery, wrapped in a tarred cloth, preserved. And of course, Odhry was part of the monastic estates at the time, and something of this status certainly would not have been from a small parish church. So we think that largely it probably was one of the things that was possibly hidden after the dissolution, so that it wasn't sold off or given away, as it were, something, you know, particularly important.
Tell us a little bit about the life of the church in Glastonbury today. I imagine that you've got a parish church is now the focus.
We've got a parish church in St John's over the road. There's also a couple of other churches in the town. There's St Benedict's down at the bottom, an older church than St John's is, down on the western edge of the town. And there's a couple of other chapels of other denomination, Methodist chapel and various other ones around the town. We also have modern alternative religions as well. So we've got a goddess temple and various other religious institutions and sites within the town itself. So it's a very vibrant and alternative and different community.
I imagine that Richard Whiting would have been rather perturbed about something like that, a goddess temple in Glastonbury.
I imagine he likely would have been, but again, we're looking at it from that filter of modernity. You know, we're assuming, of course, he would have had some issue with whatever was going on in Glastonbury today. But then we're looking at a time when Richard Whiting was about, where there was no alternative to the practiced way. The church was the church, and anything outside of that was considered radicalisation or basically heresy. Certainly something like the goddess temple, or certainly something like any other religion we see in Glastonbury today, other forms of Christianity would have been considered a massive no-go area, basically, at the time. So it's not that he would have found that particularly unusual, it's that he would have found pretty much everything we do here in modern life completely outlandish, unusual, and in some way heretical, probably. So it's
punishable by death.
Punishable by death, possibly, yeah, or excommunication or something.
Can I just ask you personally what drew you to come work here, and what's your personal journey been?
Well, I've actually lived in Glastonbury my entire life. Grew up here as a boy, went to all the local schools, and I went off to university, to Bristol University, and studied archaeology, did a postgraduate diploma in archaeology there, and after that was looking for a job, and they had jobs here for costumed guides available, dressed up to tell the history of the Abbey in a historical costume. I'd done a bit of historical reenactment in the past. I thought, this is a brilliant idea. When I'm in between jobs, you know, come and do that. Started doing the guiding here. Absolutely loved it. The Abbey's been my playground as a child and all sorts of things. So it was right up my street. Lots of archaeology, lots of history here. And then I guess I kept making myself more and more useful until they kept me here. That's the idea.
Are you still doing research on archaeology and on the history of this place?
Very much so. The Abbey in general is always involved in research. We're always looking at our own collections, let alone collections that other people have, to learn as much more as we can. As I mentioned at the digital panels, we've just finished a large project in collaboration with Reading University that has been looking at a lot of the excavations and work that have been done over the past century to really tie up any loose ends before any new research can be done. So yes, certainly every year we're looking at things. We have a curator and a learning department that do look.
Give us an idea of some of the more recent discoveries that have thrown some light on the life here.
We learned a lot recently about, as I mentioned, the Anglo-Saxon monastery here and about its form, function and layout. Before, we knew some bits, but it was very much generalisations. Now, for example, we've learned a lot about the way life worked in the Anglo-Saxon monastery and the way craft worked. We found evidence for Anglo-Saxon glass working furnaces on the site here, which were situated where the cloisters are today. And through the research we've recently done, these glass furnaces have been able to be dated to be the earliest glass working furnaces in Britain on the site here in an Anglo-Saxon context. And probably they're glass furnaces using recycled glass, either Roman glass from the continent or Roman glass from Britain, or maybe glass shipped in from abroad to make articles, whether it's window glass, glass vessels, glass beads. And this is a very refined and high status craft, as it were, very difficult craft to do. So we're finding all sorts of exciting things. So we could say, until another site is discovered early, and thus we're the earliest site of Anglo-Saxon glass working in Britain, and we found that out only a few years ago, for example.
Fascinating that we're still finding things out about this site. It's an absolute rich seam of history. So, Luke, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests from Glastonbury Abbey. That's Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder. Hearing there about what the Abbey produced for Somerset. That is wool, meat, fish, alcohol and building materials. A fantastic amount for 800 years up until 1539, where the brave abbot Richard Whiting was executed under the orders of Thomas Cromwell and King Henry VIII in the dissolution of the monasteries. They just took all of the wealth of the monasteries for themselves. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till the same time next week here on Dialect, goodbye for now.